listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the 31st Hollywood issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is a double issue that covers December 2024 and January 2025. And this is Vanity Fair Part B. This issue has numerous Hollywood stars on the cover. Now here's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief, with a letter, accompanied by a photo of Radhika Jones, photographed at the FX and Vanity Fair Emmy party on September 14th. Surprise! It's the Vanity Fair Hollywood issue, a few months earlier than you expected. For 30 years, our tentpole issue has been timed more or less to the Oscars. But as summer film festivals and major fall releases play an ever more important role in the journey toward an Academy Award, we wanted our readers and listeners and viewers to join us for the full scope of the season, to anticipate, along with us, both the accolades awaiting the films in theaters right now and the movies we can't wait to see in 2025. Think of this Hollywood issue, with its new arrival date, as the beginning of a long and glorious red carpet, winding from the Critics' Honors and Golden Globes, through the Guild and Independent Film Awards, all the way to the industry's biggest night, and of course, the Vanity Fair Oscar party. We're delighted to present our traditional group cover in print, Some Things Don't Change, as well as a series of still portraits, all photographed by Gordon Von Steiner and styled by George Cortina. But you must experience the Hollywood issue online and in motion to truly appreciate the dynamism of this power ensemble. At our shoot in mid-September, I loved seeing the connections and chemistry among them, the hugs between Josh O'Connor and Jonathan Bailey on arrival, Dev Patel and Bill Skarsgård chatting in the hallway between takes. In our video cover, directed by Gordon, the stars trade jokes and award show memories. In a suite of longer videos, they share their secret obsessions, from Dev's fascination with tiny cars, Mita's adorable Fiat named Peanut, to Josh's passion for ceramics, to Sydney Sweeney's very relatable love of cheese. In their Q&As, we hear about Jonathan's dance moves in Wicked, and Zoe Saldana's in Emilia Perez, and Nicole Kidman name-checks a few directors she'd like to work with. Catherine Bigelow and Martin Scorsese take note. As Rebecca Ford writes so eloquently in her accompanying essay, our cover stars share a propensity to take risk and propel themselves into new spaces, whether they're just starting out or already established, and we have nothing but admiration. Feast your eyes on the pictures here and explore the site for full interviews, clips, and behind-the-scenes photos from the shoot. Beyond Hollywood, we bring you several exclusive features, including an interview with Karen Reed, the defendant in a murder trial that has captured global attention. In advance of a second trial, the first ended in a mistrial, Reed spoke to Vanity Fair's Julie Miller over the course of 3 intense days, sharing her version of the events that led to her boyfriend's death and what her life has been like as she awaits her fate. We also bring you a literary revelation. Augusta Britt, a woman who met Cormac McCarthy when she was 16 and became his muse. For decades, she's been immortalized in his words, but now she tells her own story. Here are some of the contributors to the issue. Vincenzo Barney, All the Pretty Little Horses. Barney is at work on a book about Cormac McCarthy and Augusta Britt. More of his writing can be found on his Substack, Barney's Rubble. Nate Freeman, McQueen's Gambit. I've always been fascinated by visual artists who make Hollywood films, and Steve McQueen is perhaps the best to ever make that crossover, says Freeman, Vanity Fair's culture correspondent, who profiled the director ahead of Blitz, his much-anticipated World War II epic. Lily Annalick, All Her Own. Joan Didion's style is confessional, yet she's actually quite guarded, quite opaque, says Annalick, Vanity Fair contributing editor and author of Didion and Babbitts, published by Scribner, out now. Finding Noel Pimentel, her lover, mentor, tormentor, and muse, felt like finding her wet, beating heart. It was thrilling. Diana Markosian, Karen Reed's fight. Markosian sought to bring a sense of intimacy to the images she made of Karen Reed. Her second monograph, Father, published by Aperture, was published this fall. Chayeska Fortune Smith, McQueen's Gambit. Smith recounts a velvety warmth that permeated the room when Steve McQueen arrived to set. The photographer, who describes her work as classical with a twist of illusion, was recently featured in designer Simone Rocha's debut monograph. James Robinault, Murder at Hammersmith Farm. Paul Landis lived a lifetime in his 3 years with the Kennedys, says lawyer and presidential historian Robinault, who uncovered details about a spoof film the Secret Service agent starred in alongside John and Jacqueline Kennedy. Behind the Issue by John Ross. In the photos, Zoe Saldana, stylist George Cortina, Zendaya, and Glenn Powell, photographer Gordon von Steiner, Josh O'Connor, Sydney Sweeney, Danielle Deadweiler, and Jonathan Bailey, in Shuti Katwa and Lisa, Nicole Kidman, and Dev Patel. What more can you want from a weekend than seeing Zendaya hum along to Solange and play with her miniature Schnauzer Noon? Over two sunny days in September, Vanity Fair brought a dozen thrilling actors together at Milk Studios in Los Angeles to shoot the cover for our 31st annual Hollywood issue. Noon was an adorable and very chill plus one. Photographer and director Gordon von Steiner shot the cover, and George Cortina styled the stars, as they did so memorably last year, and used American Gigolo as an inspiration. The production involved 24 trunks, 50 boxes, 30 racks of clothing, 200 pairs of shoes, 4 security guards for the dazzling jewelry, and too many non-dairy iced lattes to count. Glenn Powell flew in from a set on only 1 hour's sleep, said our Hollywood cover has been on his bucket list, then flew out again. Zoe Saldana confessed she'd been living out of boxes while her home underwent renovation. Lisa, the actor and singer from Blackpink, revealed her love for Pop Mart figures in one of the cheeky Obsession videos you can find at VF.com, along with Q&As. Nobody's gauche enough to name a favorite star to work with, but when asked about Nicole Kidman, Cortina said simply, "She's a dream." Here's the 2024 Vanity Fair Gift Guide. 118 items for the stylish giver to surprise and delight everyone on your list, with opening photograph by Ryan Geno, which shows various items and wrapped packages. For the magnetic, tug at the heartstrings within the mood for love, a visual feast of amorous highs and melancholic lows. Red letter, Givenchy coat. Typology lip oil in one ruby red. Harry Winston necklace. Montblanc fountain pen. Amelia Wickstead dress. Sandy Lang hair elastic. Diptyque Paris Frondies candle. Cartier buttonhole gem. Simone Rocha earrings. Alyssa Bell memo box. Sophie Lou Jacobson vase. J.W. Anderson shirt. Merit Flush Balm and Persimmon. Saint Laurent by Anthony Vaccarello Shoes. Guerlain Patchouli Paris Eau de Parfum. In the photos, Tony Long Chihua and Maggie Chung Manyuk in the Mood for Love from 2001. For the Rebel, master the Force and channel a galaxy far, far away, as inspired by The Empire Strikes Back. In the photo, David Prowse as Darth Vader in The Empire Strikes Back, 1980. And Out of This World, pictured here, Fluff Lip Oil in one original clear, Third Ritual Moon Body Lotion, Entire Studios Tank, Moncler and Rick Owens Jacket, Vaunus Hestia Smartphone Telescope Set, Camper Lab Sneakers, Lark Water Bottle, Zip Beauty Facial Toning Device, Nikos Koulis Earrings, Rimowa Bag, Ice Clinical Eclipse SPF 50+, Gucci Bag, Agostina Spader Eye Cream, Movado Watch, iRobot, Roomba Combo 10, Max Robot, and Apple iPhone 16 in Ultramarine. For the day tripper, add a romantic adventure a la Roman Holiday to your wish list. In the photo, Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck in Roman Holiday, 1953. When in Rome, photographed Borghese Bagno di Vita Shower Gel, Vacheron Constantine Watch, Smithson Diary, Chanel No. 5 Eau de Parfum Spray Collector's Edition, Unibuffa Shoes, Bulgari Necklace, Saint Laurent by Anthony Vaccarello Blazer, Rossiolo Tomato and Basil Sauce, Bottega Veneta Shirt, Cafe Panna Ice Cream, Leica Camera, Dorso Robe, Fendi Handbag, Vespa Motorcycle, Asli Charm, and Brunello Cucinelli Skirt. For the lovers, borrow Cupid's wings and indulge the heart's most tender entreaties in a fashion befitting Romeo and Juliet. In the photo, Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio in Romeo and Juliet from 1996. And Boundless Beauty. In the photos, Doyne Dress, Complete Works, Jug, Colleen Allen Bloomers, McQueen by Sean McGurr Shirt, Danusera Face Cream, David Yurman Necklace, Valentino Pumps, Orlebar Brown Shirt, Mikamoto Bracelet, Violette French Jelly Lip Balm and Bonbon a la Rose, Pandora Charm, Dior Beauty Glow Face Palette and 006 Celestial Glow, Maison Madeleine Daybed, Van Cleef & Arpels Earrings, John Darien Plate, La Double J Wine Glasses Set of 4, Alice Mushrooms Happy Ending Chocolates Set of 2. For the wonderful, ease on down the road. Follow in the silver-slippered steps of the Wiz. In the photo, Nipsey Russell, Diana Ross, Michael Jackson, and Ted Ross in the Wiz, 1978. Have a Heart. In the photos, Charles Jeffrey Loverboy Sweater, Charlotte Tilbury Eyeshadow and Pillow Talk Ultraviolet, Dior Lady Art Bag in collaboration with Danielle McKinney, West Elm Pillow, Jonathan Adler Pillow, Graff Earrings, Prada coat, Face Vessel vases, Valentino vest, Aida shoes, Tory Burch dress, Dies and Durga steamed rainbow eau de parfum, Giants art from the Dean collection of Swizz Beatz and Alicia Keys by Swizz Beatz, published by Kasim Dean and Alicia Keys, with an interview by Kimberly Grant. Brent Neal bracelet. And for the naturalist, let Jurassic Park remind you that life, finds a way, even as the laws of nature and hubris of man collide. In the photo, Laura Dern and Sam Neill in Jurassic Park, 1993. Soaring high in the photos, L.L. Bean coat, Cartier sunglasses, the Elder Statesman blanket, Bottega Veneta Eau de Parfum in Frassino, Hermes Butte nail polish in vert bronze, Rolex date just 31 watch, Flamingo Estate Manuka rich cream, Philippe Malouin for floss lamp, Laurel Piana pants, Found My Animal leash, Fendi men's hat, Swarovski optic binoculars, nail spag, mud puppy puzzle, and snow peak tent. In the gallery from Daisy Shaw Ellis, Season's Greenings. Photograph by Ryan Jenk of Loy Knit Flamenco Purse. With its bright green faux fur exterior, it may evoke visions of the devious Grinch. This colorful handbag's primary concern is merrymaking. Whether snuggled in the crook of your arm during a chilly evening, or basking like a fluorescent napping lapdog in the warm glow of a crackling fire, this cozy accessory could lift even a Scrooge's spirits. In the photo, Chanel watches. Bust long necklace couture. Good form. When working in her couturier, Coco Chanel often wore her fabric shears as though they were a pendant, dangling from a long ribbon around her neck. The ad hoc accessory serves as inspiration for this diamond-encrusted dress form on an 18-karat gold necklace. The miniature figure cleverly hides a watch face in the retractable waistline, proving that frivolity and luxury can be practical, too. Let It Glow, in the photo, Van Cleef & Arpels, Mousqueton de Grenat earrings. Visions of sugar plums will dance on your head with Van Cleef & Arpels' glistening drop earrings, a combined almost 30 carats of amber-colored spessartite garnets, flanked by sparkling diamonds. Just be warned that this impressive pair, set in 18-carat gold, may whisk you away into a marzipan dream state. Now on to books. Good on Paper. From opulent imagery to entertaining tips, exquisite books worth festooning with gift wrap and bows. As summarized by Keziah Weir. For the dance revolutionary, Frank DeCaro's Disco traces the era's grit and glitz with playlist and insider accounts galore. For the three-dimensional thinker, in Great Women Sculptors, Lisa Lefebvre fets artist from Uma Baba to Helen Escobedo. For the horse gal, from Duke Phillips III Ranchlands, a bucolic photo survey of the beloved Western ranch. For the discerning eye, Carla Sazzani, Art, Life, Fashion, is Louise Baring's lush, illustrated biography of the Italian fashion editor and retail queen. For the bon vivant, bring the Michelin-starred Brooklyn Wine Bar home with Nick Curtola's The Four Horsemen Cookbook. For the host with the most, Pierre Sauvage lays out the tablescapes and recipes of the fabulous set and how they entertain at home with the tastemakers. For the Artie Hart, Sam Gilliam spans 5 decades of work from the trailblazing painter. For the Shop Hop, art, ephemera, and a rich history fill Tim Allis's Henri Bendel and the worlds he fashioned. For the Scent Hound, Leonardo da Vinci and the Perfumes of the Renaissance, by Pascal Breuist and Carlo Vesci, presents the master as fragrance artist. Read the Room. 10 illustrious bookworms share their recent favorites. By Keziah Weir. Lupita Nyong'o, actor, A Quiet Place, Day 1. I love that world, says the actor of Brian K. Vaughan's space fantasy comic Saga, one of her frequent rereads. He writes in such a clipped way, and there's a vibe to his writing that I really enjoy. Robin Wall Kimmerer, author, The Serviceberry. How to choose just one book, the botanist asked. Still, Leslie Marmon Silka's Gardens in the Dunes, a powerful story of indigenous women's identity and their cultural plants, lifts me up. John Favreau, author of Democracy or Else. The Pod Save America co-host says Eric Kleinenberg's 2020 One City, Seven People and the Year Everything Changed gave him hope of regaining the sense of solidarity and community we lost in the pandemic. Anna Wyant, artist, who's afraid of the big bad wolves? I adore Setsuko's work, says the painter. Into Nature shows how she creates her beautiful sculptures and paintings through installation images and personal photos. Dua Lipa, singer-songwriter, radical optimism, the self-described back catalog kind of girl and founder of the editorial platform Service 95, is obsessed with George Orwell's 1984. It could have been written as a comment on our world today. Kaveh Akbar, author, martyr, the poet and novelist, says of Lina Khalaf Tafaya's Something About Living, the joy in Tafaya's poems is always a joy made by having known profound grief. Their rage arises from a surfeit of tenderness. Nate Silver, author, on the edge. For the 538 founder, Ben Smith's Traffic is the best history I've read of the online content game and the personalities who are attracted to it, and the frequent missteps they've made, chasing eyeballs and page views. Kaya Gerber, actor, Saturday Night. In Dear Dickhead, Virginie Despentes casually swings around big ideas of anti-wokeness, gender addiction, and more, says the co-founder of the reading platform Library Science. Amanda Gorman, poet, The Sacred Scene. Burnout by sisters Emily and Amelia Nagoski served for the country's first youth poet laureate as a fun but deeply science-based book that can help transform your life and the decisions you make. Laura Ramoso, comedian, Sit Up Straight Tour. Despite being not typically a self-help kind of reader, the comedian says Stephen Pressfield's The Art of War is her favorite book of all time. It's kind of like my Bible, except with a lot more swearing. And moving on to the fairground, London Calling, lashing rain didn't keep the stars from opening their arms and hearts in support of film preservation at the British Film Institute's annual Luminous Gala. In the photographs by Oliver Holmes, Nathalie Emmanuel, Daisy Edgar Jones, Richard E. Grant, Sonoya Mizuno, Lashana Lynch, Naomi Aki, Celia Emery, Sandy Powell, Tilda Swinton, and Dexter Fletcher.
Thank you.
The Art of the Deal, what it took to get my movie about Donald Trump and Roy Cohn in front of an audience, by Gabriel Sherman. Opening photo, Sebastian Stan, who plays Donald Trump in The Apprentice, was one of the few Hollywood actors interested in the role. On the night of May 20th, I stood in the storied auditorium Louis Lumiere at Cannes and listened as more than 2,000 people in black tie gave an 8-minute standing ovation for the film I wrote, The Apprentice. The movie is a Frankenstein's monster origin story about Donald Trump, played by Sebastian Stan in prosthetics and a golden toupee. It follows Trump as he rises in Manhattan real estate under the tutelage of lawyer-turned-fixer Roy Cohn, played with dead-eyed menace by Jeremy Strong. One scene depicts Trump sexually assaulting his first wife, Ivana. Others showed Trump getting liposuction, undergoing scalp reduction surgery, and popping amphetamine diet pills. Details reported in Harry Hurt III's 1993 Trump biography, Lost Tycoon. Trump denied the claims at the time. During the after party, with views of oligarch-owned yachts anchored in the harbor, I began getting alerts on my phone. Trump announced he planned to sue to block the movie's release. Campaign spokesperson Stephen Chung called the movie malicious defamation and election interference by Hollywood elites. I had a pit in my stomach, but I also felt strangely validated. Trump's legal threat followed the first rule Cohn elucidates in the movie, attack, attack, attack. 2 days later, Trump's lawyer sent the film's director, Ali Abbasi, and me cease and desist letters that warned Hollywood companies against distributing the movie. I hoped the controversy and buzz would translate into a deal, but by the time I flew home, no Hollywood company had made an offer to release the movie in the United States. In the spring of 2017, millions of Americans were processing the reality that Trump occupied the White House. Some turned to therapy, others booze. I coped by writing a screenplay. My first journalism job was reporting on Manhattan real estate for the weekly New York Observer. So you can imagine my shock when I found myself covering Trump's first presidential campaign. Roger Stone told me Trump was winning because he followed Cohn's three rules: attack, 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 deny everything, admit nothing, and always claim victory. The insight sparked the idea to write a fictional film about Cohn molding his apprentice. Their relationship had elements of a Shakespearean drama. Desperate to outshine his provincial father, Trump sold his soul to learn Cohn's dark arts. But Trump virtually abandoned Cohn while Cohn was dying from AIDS in the mid-1980s. In the fall of 2017, my agent sold the pitch to Amy Baer, a former top studio executive who runs a small film development company. Baer believed in the idea for the same reason I did. In our hyper-polarized culture, portraying Trump as human was a radical act. We then recruited Abbasi, an acclaimed Iranian-Danish filmmaker. No major Hollywood studio or streamer wanted to finance the film. "Call me if Trump loses," one top executive said at a party after he told me how much he loved the script. But even then, studios still passed. That meant we would have to finance the movie independently. Baer would raise most of the production budget by pre-selling rights to distribute the film abroad. An equity investor would provide the rest of the money, and we would show the movie at a major festival to entice a U.S. distributor. Baer's ability to pre-sell depended on casting stars with international fan bases to play Trump and Cohn. I wasn't prepared for actors, many of whom were hashtag resistance members, to be reluctant about the movie. One turned down the role of Trump, saying he didn't want to give his humanity to the president. Stan was the exception. Eventually, we signed Emmy winner Jeremy Strong, who was looking for post-succession roles to play Cone. Even after we found our cast, the movie died and was resurrected many times. Trump's Muslim travel ban made it virtually impossible for Abbasi to work on the movie in the United States. Then there was a global pandemic, the bursting of the Hollywood content bubble, and dual writers and actors strikes. In the spring of 2023, Abbasi was at Cannes promoting his Iranian serial killer film Holy Spider, when he was contacted by a 29-year-old filmmaker and producer named Mark Rappaport. Rappaport told Abbasi to meet him on an unremarkable boat that ferried him to a 305-foot yacht. It belonged to Rappaport's father-in-law, the billionaire and Trump donor Dan Snyder, who had loaned Rappaport millions to help grow his production company, Kinematics. Why did Snyder, who donated $1 million to Trump's 2016 inauguration, allow his money to go into an R-rated film that depicts Trump as a sex predator? The answer, as best as I can tell, is that Snyder didn't know what kind of Trump movie his son-in-law was making. Lawyers who have represented Snyder in the past did not return a request for comment. And why would my producers finance a dark Trump movie with money from a pro-Trump billionaire? As studios limit output, filmmakers seeking to finance adult dramas have had to look elsewhere. One enduring source of capital comes from the children, or spouses of the children, of the 0.1%. The problem, in our case, is that such people often have a Trump connection. We wrapped production in late January after a 32-day shoot. The plan was to premiere the movie at the Venice Film Festival in late August, but then our financier told Abbasi to get the movie ready to play at Cannes in May to quickly recoup. Snyder planned to host a party in Cannes on his yacht. Rappaport agreed to invest $450,000 more in the film. In late March, Abbasi delivered his rough cut to producers. That's when I became aware of a war playing out between Abbasi and Rappaport. The biggest issue was the sexual assault scene, which dramatized allegations Ivana made in a deposition during her 1990 divorce. Ivana later clarified that when she had used the word rape under oath, she didn't mean Trump assaulted her in a criminal sense, only that she felt violated. She fully recanted her sworn testimony when Trump was running for president 25 years later. Rappaport and his business partner told Abbasi the scene was too risky to portray. Making matters worse, Rappaport screened the rough cut for his father-in-law at his Caribbean vacation home. Abbasi's draft included an improvised dream sequence in which Strong wore a skin-tight frog costume and climbed into bed with Stan and caressed his face. Snyder eventually walked out. "I thought it was funny when I was on set, but this is not in the script," Rappaport told Abbasi and producers on a Zoom. Abbasi agreed the scene didn't work, but he and I refused to cut the sexual assault scene because we believed Ivana's sworn deposition. Trump has been credibly accused of sexual assault by many women over the years. He has denied all accusations. On a certain level, I felt for Rappaport stuck on an island with his billionaire father-in-law. He had financed the movie when no one else would. In the weeks leading up to Cannes, Rappaport's lawyers sent producers cease and desist letters to stop the movie from playing the festival he had asked us to submit to in the first place. Rappaport only dropped his legal threats because the French distributor owned the movie in France. Still, there would be no yacht party. In June, Briarcliff Entertainment made an offer to release The Apprentice in theaters before the election. The small company was founded by Tom Ortenberg, a veteran executive with a track record of distributing commercially successful political films. But Rappaport wanted to hold out for a better deal, which seemed absurd because every other buyer had already passed. Rappaport was the movie's largest equity investor, which gave him power to approve domestic distribution. Would he really catch and kill his own movies? I told Strong that it was like we were living inside an episode of Succession. It would be impossible to release the movie in the U.S. before the election if the Briarcliff deal didn't close by Labor Day. I consoled myself that at least the film would be released in other countries in October, even in Vladimir Putin's Russia. That hope died when producers told me international distributors didn't have the legal right to screen the movie before it played domestically. In the end, a pair of investors, Fred Benenson and James Shaney, came together to buy out Rappaport's stake. The deal closed hours before the movie was scheduled to make its American premiere at the Telluride Film Festival. As our October general release neared, I braced for a lawsuit. Talking about the movie puts him in a bad mood, a source close to the Trump campaign told me. In a social media post, the weekend of release, Trump called the movie cheap and defamatory, and maintained he and Ivana had a great relationship until her death. He also called me a lowlife and talentless hack. In a screenplay, a character's lowest moment is called the dark night of the soul. It's the final test that forces the protagonist to confront his worst fears and change. My dark night of the soul lasted 4 months as the movie lingered in purgatory. I'm a natural pessimist who assumes the worst will happen, so I can be pleasantly surprised if anything goes right. My therapist asked me to accept forces I can't control and imagine a world in which things work out. Making this movie helped me to finally grasp these concepts. Whether or not Trump files a lawsuit, Cohn's lessons worked in a way. The threat alone was enough to delay a deal for months. Cohn has been dead for nearly 40 years, but we are still living in his world. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.